I made it clear to early on to President Putin that if he were to move into Ukraine, that there'd be severe consequences.
Tensions rising along the Ukraine border. It's Thursday, January 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Jessica Stone in Washington. You'll also find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, the Kingdom of Tonga faces a food shortage. The U.S. Supreme Court takes up race-based college admissions. Norway briefs the United Nations Security Council on its talks with the Taliban, making up for lost learning due to COVID, and filling service jobs with robots. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Russia has rejected the prospect of U.S. sanctions against President Vladimir Putin, one of several proposed responses if Russia forces were to invade neighboring Ukraine. At the same time, Moscow says it is watching with great concern an American move to put 8,500 troops on alert for possible deployment to Eastern Europe. As VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports, diplomatic efforts continue as the United States and NATO boost their military deterrence.
Russia's military buildup along its border with Ukraine and in Belarus is continuing. President Joe Biden told reporters in Washington Tuesday, saying he is now ready to boost U.S. and NATO deterrence in Eastern Europe, but would not send U.S. troops to Ukraine.
I made it clear to early on to President Putin that if he were to move into Ukraine, that there'd be severe consequences, including significant economic sanctions, as well as I'd feel obliged to beef up our presence, NATO's presence, on the Eastern Front, Poland, Romania, etc.
Asked if he would consider sanctioning Russian President Vladimir Putin personally, Biden said yes, he would. The United States, Britain, Australia, and Germany have ordered the families of diplomats living in Kyiv to leave Ukraine. Some Ukrainian officials say the move was premature. Oleksiy Danilov is Secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council.
We must remain calm today. We don't see in reality the situation that is being inflated in the media now.
Asked if the U.S. agrees with Ukraine's assessment, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said this.
Well, no one can get into the mind of President Putin or Russian leadership. We all know that is the case. What we have seen is a range of preparations, including 100,000 troops at the border, bellicose rhetoric, and actions, as we've talked about in here, including false flag operations to try to spread misinformation throughout the region and even the world, setting up the predicate for an invasion.
On Monday, Biden said he had a very good meeting and that the U.S. is in complete unity with key European allies. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron to Berlin Tuesday, and they agreed that Russia would face severe sanctions if it invades Ukraine. Macron said he would speak to Putin on Friday. The diplomatic efforts come as Russia is sending troops and military equipment to Belarus, worrying observers. William Hartung is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
Well, I think the troops in Belarus, it's concerning. It certainly would position Russia better if they chose to go into Ukraine. Hard to tell at this time if Putin is bluffing.
Russia says it is not planning to invade Ukraine, despite massing troops and equipment along the border and in Belarus, and is accusing the United States of escalating hostilities. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Required app raises fears China will track sensitive data during Olympics. Australian naval ship to deliver relief supplies to Tonga. Thailand first in Asia to decriminalize marijuana. Mekong region sees new species despite intense threat. Seoul says it paid Iran's delinquent UN dues to restore vote. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The Chinese capital, Beijing, reported 14 new coronavirus cases on Wednesday as it began a third round of mass testing of millions of people in the run-up to next month's Winter Olympics. The procedures are testing the patients of some residents who say they have to stand in line almost daily in freezing temperatures. International Olympic Committee IOC President Thomas Bach delivered a video message to the China Media Group Forum held on Wednesday. He called for the Olympic spirit of unity to dominate the Games.
The best winter sport athletes of the world will compete with each other for Olympic glory while living peacefully together under one roof in the Olympic Village. In this way, they will send a powerful message from Beijing to the world. We can only go faster. We can only aim higher. We can only become stronger if we stand together in solidarity.
The Beijing Winter Olympic Games begin Friday, February 4th. Tongan people are now facing dire food shortages in the wake of the devastating volcanic eruptions on January 14th and 15th. The current food left in the country is merely enough to support local people's life for no more than a week or two. The deadly volcanic eruptions and ensuing tsunami have devastated local agriculture and severely damaged crops in Tonga. Here's Louise Waterhouse, General Consul of Tonga in Sydney.
The poorer news is that they had a 36-hour power failure in Tonga, which meant that all their frozen goods were lost. So there's a dire shortage of food. So we're looking for canned food to be sending to Tonga and of course, further water supplies. And also the crops. I don't know if I mentioned last time, but the fields have been totally blanketed in ash, which has destroyed the current crop in Tonga. Luckily, the root crops underground should be okay, but anything above the ground has been destroyed. So we're really concerned about food supplies going forward for the Tongan people.
The general consul also said that they are now looking for canned food and further water supplies to be sent into Tonga to ease the dire food shortage in the country. Meantime, we're getting a better idea when the undersea communications cable, which connects Tonga to the outside world, will be repaired. Here's Samuela Fanua, chairman of Tonga Cable Limited.
Most probably the second week of February, we may have our connection online again. There are two internet service providers in Tonga that we provide capacity to them to offer internet services to the people. So right now, they are still offering internet services, very limited internet services, but using satellite communication.
Fanua says repairs to the cable should begin as early as next week. Protests against Australia Day were held nationwide as other residents celebrated the country's National Day. Protesters argue historical wrongs were committed against the country's Indigenous people. First Nations activist Elizabeth Jarrett.
Thank you all for coming here today to understand what today represents for First Nations people. Today's a national holiday. You're told to go and have a beer and a barbecue and celebrate the genocide of our people. So I thank each and every one of you from the bottom of our hearts, from all First Nations people that stand here today.
Clifford Peter joined what he's calling Invasion Day protests.
It was Invasion Day for us, like a lot of our old people, like a lot of our ancestors got basically murdered on this day, you know, and hunted down like an animal. And so we just want to get recognition.
Australia Day signifies the 1788 landing of British convict ships in Sydney and the settlement established by those on board. Still ahead on VOA Asia, is the Supreme Court signaling a shift on affirmative action? Happening now in Asia. Responding to a surge in anti-Asian violence in the United States over the past year, San Francisco is ordering a higher police presence across its Chinatown area ahead of the Lunar New Year holiday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. So happy you could join us here on VOA Asia. The Supreme Court this week announced it would hear two cases challenging the practice by some U.S. universities of using the race of an applicant as one of the factors that affects admissions. The court said it would combine two cases, one brought against Harvard University and another against the University of North Carolina. The central question identified by the court in both cases is whether it should overturn its own previous ruling that allowed universities to use race as a factor in admissions decisions. Mark Sherman covers the Supreme Court for the Associated Press.
The Supreme Court's interest in taking this case is a strong suggestion that there may be a majority on the court for overturning those precedents and limiting, if not eliminating, the use of race in college admissions.
The affirmative action case will not be heard until the court's next term begins in October. The U.S. Coast Guard is searching for 39 people missing for several days after a boat believed to be used for human smuggling capsized off Florida's coast en route from the Bahamas. The Maritime Security Agency tweeted that a Good Samaritan alerted the Coast Guard early Tuesday after rescuing a man clinging to the boat 45 miles east of Fort Pierce. The man said he was part of a group of people who left the island of Bimini in the Bahamas on Saturday night. He said the boat capsized in severe weather. The Coast Guard is calling it a suspected human smuggling case. The city council in San Jose, California, has overwhelmingly approved a law requiring gun owners to carry liability insurance. The insurance law is believed to be the first measure of its kind in the United States. Mayor Sam Liccardo of San Jose.
This ordinance has two elements. First, we require every gun owner in the city to have insurance, just as every driver has to have insurance to use a car. And second, we would be funding violence prevention initiatives with a fee that would be levied on gun owners so that we could invest in reducing domestic violence and suicide and provide mental health services and other kinds of services, particularly to households in which a gun is owned.
The proposed ordinance is part of a broad gun control plan that Liccardo announced following the May 26th mass shooting at the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority rail yard that left 9 people dead, including the employee who opened fire on his colleagues. But critics argue that the fee and liability requirements violate their right to bear arms and do nothing to stop gun crimes, including the use of untraceable build-it-yourself ghost guns. Sam Paredes is the executive director of Gun Owners of California.
California either affects or infects what happens throughout the country. In this case, we would look at this as an unconstitutional infection that we want to stop here. So there will be a lawsuit filed asking for an injunction that will prevent this from going into effect, and then ultimately having the ordinance declared unconstitutional and overturned.
The measure does not address the massive problem of illegally obtained weapons that are stolen or purchased without background checks. Read and see more on this story at VOA Asia Facebook.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
Happening now in Asia. Cambodian Prime Minister and ASEAN Chair Hun Sen, in a video call with military chief Min Aung Hlaing, urged Myanmar's military ruler to facilitate a visit by a special envoy and to help provide humanitarian aid to those who need it most. All the big stories coming your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter, Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The UN Security Council held a session on Wednesday on the situation in Afghanistan. The Norwegian Prime Minister briefed the members after his country hosted talks this week between the Taliban and Afghan civil society. The three-day talks concluded Tuesday amid protests and criticism, particularly from Afghan rights groups, of Norway's decision to host the Islamist Taliban who seized power in Afghanistan last August. Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre.
So this is, a measure that makes it possible to hold those who hold power in Afghanistan accountable and to really communicate the clear needs. I know this is a challenge for many to see the Taliban being received in Oslo. It is also something that is a troubling thing for many people, including for me. But the alternative, to leave Afghanistan, 1 million children at the danger of starving, half of the population in need of humanitarian aid, 90% of the economy really out of any proper working, that is no option. So we have to deal with the world as it is, and that's why talking to Taliban, holding them accountable, is the right thing to do.
Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, also defended the decision to speak with the Taliban.
I think we can trust them in the sense that they are the de facto authorities in the country, and they see how the economy is collapsing at the moment, and the enormous need to have the aid from the Western countries. Much of that aid is, by the way, frozen. And the sanctions that are in place vis-a-vis Afghanistan is holding us back. We cannot save lives unless all of the sanctions are lifted. It's hurting the same civilians that the NATO countries spent hundreds of billions on defending up until August.
Taliban delegates led by Foreign Minister Amir Khan Muttaqi met with members of Afghan civil society, including women, followed by multilateral talks with diplomats from the U.S., EU, Britain, France, Italy, and the UN, and host Norway. The closed-door meetings, which took place at a hotel outside Oslo, Norway, were supposed to cover a wide range of issues, including education for Afghan women and greater inclusivity in the caretaker government the Taliban have established since taking over the conflict-torn nation. No country has yet recognized the Taliban regime, which gained power in mid-August as the Western-backed government collapsed. Remaining U.S.-led foreign troops withdrew from the country later that month, ending a 20-year occupation. Indonesia and Singapore have signed a bilateral extradition agreement. It's a move that Jakarta expects to help authorities in their effort to bring to justice those accused of stashing billions of dollars offshore in state monies. Senior cabinet ministers from both countries also signed bilateral agreements covering airspace and defense in a ceremony aired on Indonesia's State Secretariat YouTube channel. Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong says it will also be attractive to investors. Making headlines in Asia, Thailand's Navy worked Wednesday to control a 160,000-liter oil spill, which leaked from a pipeline in waters off the country's east coast. A surveillance plane, two ships, and a helicopter were sent to aid in the cleanup effort. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia. A United Nations agency reports 128 million children are losing out on education because of COVID-19, up from 75 million in pre-pandemic days. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since it was launched as a UN Global Fund 5 years ago, Education Cannot Wait has provided a quality education for 4.5 million children trapped in more than 30 of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Fund officials say they now will be able to help an additional 2.5 million children and youth thanks to a generous contribution from the German government of more than $228 million. The money, they say, will allow millions of young people caught up in armed conflict, forced displacement, climate-induced emergencies, and other disasters to get an education. Germany's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Katharina Stasch, says COVID-19 has threatened gains made in all areas, including education. She says many children cannot and do not return to school even when they reopen. She says this is unacceptable, as education is key to tackling all the challenges of our time.
Worldwide, there are 34 million displaced children and youth. Their number will continue to grow as a result of the global climate crisis, and girls are particularly at risk. We have a shared responsibility not to lose this generation. We must not leave anybody behind.
The director of Education Cannot Wait, Yasmin Sharif, says her agency provides children with a full package of curriculum, learning, protection, school feeding, and psychosocial services. Everything that is necessary to achieve a good standard of education.
Which is absolutely critical if we are to achieve any of the other sustainable development goals or human rights. unless the generation of children and youth in countries like Burkina Faso, Chad, Syria, Afghanistan, Central African Republic, Rohingyas, receive a 12-year education, we will achieve very little elsewhere in the goals that we have set for ourselves.
Sharif acknowledges Education Cannot Wait operates in challenging environments that are in a constant state of flux. She says the program can function despite the many crises and conflicts around the world because of its status as a United Nations fund. As such, she says the agency has systems and security in place that provide protection. The structure, she says, also enables agency staff to have contact with de facto governments and militia groups they otherwise would not enjoy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The current difficulty in filling many service jobs in the U.S. is leaving hotels scrambling to provide room service. But with a bit of ingenuity and a little high-tech help, some American hotels are finding a way. Angelina Bagdasarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
This is the Relay Robot. It now works at the Radisson Hotel in Sunnyvale, California, because of staff shortages caused by COVID-19. The robot is a welcome presence.
There's guests that like that, the fact that they can have items delivered and not have that contact with the human being.
Basic room service that would have been handled by staff is now handled by these robots.
When you get a delivery from a robot, you are not bothering a person. And there's a sense in which, you know, when we think, oh, should I call down to the front desk or should I just go get it myself? Sometimes if you had the sense that they're busy or something, you might say, well, I'll wait, or they're too busy, it's going to take too long. When robots come, they come very fast, usually in around 5 or 6 minutes, and they don't ask for a tip. They don't. You don't have to get dressed for them. You're not bothering anybody.
Steve Cousins is CEO and founder of a company called Savioak that produces these robots. He says the trickiest bit was to teach the robots to use an elevator.
You have to get the elevator company to come out and modify the building in order for it to work, and that takes a lot of money and time. So what we've done recently is added a little button pusher to our robot where it can push the buttons by itself.
Here's how it works. Special sensors in the robot can pick the right button, avoid any obstacles it may face on the floor, and finally arrive at its destination. Once it's safely parked in front of the room door, the customer gets a message.
When you have a robot on your team, it doesn't go home. So it's always there. It's available 24/7. It's not like you have to have, you know, 3 shifts a day plus weekends. The robots are available whenever you need them. You know, the staff loves it because they're able to focus on the job they're supposed to be doing.
In California, robots are not only doing room service at hotels and delivering food, they also patrol the streets. These police robots work in the Los Angeles parks. Yet robot designers want to reassure customers that the machines will not replace people in the industry. They merely want to make life a little easier for people and safer at a time when safety is a big concern. For Angelina Bagdasarian in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Thousands of people turned out for India's Republic Day celebration Wednesday, which featured a display of military power and cultural diversity through the colorful spectacle that was curtailed by the COVID-19 pandemic. President Ramnath Kovind took the salute from the marching columns, which also included a camel-mounted regiment with its mustachioed riders led by shiny brass bands with tubas. Republic Day marks the anniversary of the adoption of the country's constitution on January 26, 1950. India won independence from British colonial rule in 1947. You have been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Keith Lane, Chris Cascajo, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Jessica Stone in Washington. Enjoy the day.